Good evening and welcome everyone to Outbeat Radio. It's the fifth Sunday of the month, so tonight we have a special show we call Outbeat Extra. If you're a first-time listener, Outbeat Radio airs every Sunday night at 8 p.m. with four different shows each month right here on KRCB Radio. My name's Greg Morelli, and I'm here tonight with Gary Carnevale. Well, 2012 is a big election year, as you all know, and we think it's really important that you be informed about those running for office, and in particular about their positions on various LGBT issues. So we're going to dedicate the show tonight, in April and in August, to interviewing the candidates who could someday become your representative right here in the North Bay. Now, our format will include interviewing candidates one at a time with the same set of questions so that you can compare and contrast their positions. And we're going to begin tonight in just a few minutes with two people vying for Lynn Woolsey's seat in Congress, Susan Adams and Norm Solomon. So stay with us, but first, here's your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, January 29th, 2012. A federal judge signaled Thursday that she's likely to strike down a federal law that denies long-term health coverage to those same-sex domestic partners of state employees in California, saying it appears to be based on the prejudice against gays and lesbians. U.S. District Judge Claudia Wilkin of Oakland said domestic partners could join a lawsuit challenging an aspect of the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, its exclusion of same-sex couples from federal tax benefits that are essential to participation in a long-term health care program for state employees. The suit is one of two in Bay Area federal courts challenging the 1996 law, which denies federal marital benefits to same-sex spouses. President Obama said in February that he considered the law unconstitutional and that he would no longer defend it in court, a role assigned to lawyers hired by House Republican leaders. The Obama administration argued before Wilkin, however, that only same-sex spouses should be allowed to sue over long-term health coverage because Congress has rational grounds for limiting tax breaks to legal relatives and excluding domestic partners. But Wilkin said same-sex couples in California are, quote, relegated to registered domestic partnerships because legal marriage is prohibited for them. Congress saw registered domestic partnership as a marriage-like status, she said, and based its decision on the couple's sexual orientation. While the ruling determined only the suit can proceed on behalf of registered domestic partners as well as spouses, Wilkin indicated, as she did in another ruling a year ago, that she is inclined to overturn the law. Federal officials have failed to show a plausible, legitimate rationale excluding registered domestic partners from the law's list of eligible family members for the tax benefits, and the court can think of none, Wilkin wrote. She added, Congress has taken numerous actions to deny recognition or benefits to same-sex domestic partners, including its refusal from 1992 to 2001 to allow Washington, D.C. to spend any funds to establish a local domestic partner registry. And here in California, the Secretary of State's office on Thursday cleared a proposal to repeal Senate Bill 48, known otherwise as the Fair, Accurate, and Inclusive Respectful Education Act. This is the act that requires LGBT history and individuals contributing to that history to be taught in California's schools. The proposal submitted by Lou Shelton of the Anti-Gay Traditional Values Coalition repeals SB 48's requirement that instructional materials recognize these contributions. Sheldon also wants to undo the law's provision that prohibits instructional materials that reflect adversely on people based on their sexual orientation and other characteristics. Backers of Shelton's initiative have until June 25th to collect some 504,760 valid signatures needed to get the proposal on the state ballot. Karen England, executive director for the Capital Resource Institute and its affiliated Capital Resource Family Impact, is backing another SB 48 repeal initiative, which is expected to be cleared for circulation sometime next month. Richard Rios, another anti-gay activist, has also proposed undoing SB 48, but said this week he's dropping his efforts. And also on Thursday, Assemblymember Mary Hayashi of Hayward introduced a bill to create the first lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender specialty license plate for California. Proceeds from the plates would go toward anti-bullying programs in the California Department of Education. She said, this will be an important opportunity for Californians to show their support for the LGBT community and address a major problem that is affecting all youth. She added, LGBT youth are at increased risk for bullying, which can have a devastating effect on their health, even leading to suicide. By purchasing this plate, the public can put a stop to bullying and help make the difference for our kids. If AB 1539 passes, it would make California the fourth state in the nation to offer LGBT-themed license plates. Believe it or not, South Carolina, Indiana, and Maryland already offer a specialty LGBT plate. And last week, we reported on the premiere of a documentary featuring a Santa Rosa family called A Right to Love an American Family. Jay Foxworthy and his partner Brian LeFou are featured along with their two children in this film that chronicles their story of courage born out of the highly mediatized and controversial Prop 8 election here in California. This married couple and their two children are fighting back against discrimination, ignorance, and hate through home videos posted on their YouTube channel, Gay Family Values. Tickets are still available for the February 6th premiere at the Castro Theater. If you'd like to order yours, go online to www.brownpapertickets/event/221824. Gary Carnevale and I will be there, and we hope you'll join us in supporting this amazing family. If you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatradio.com. Just click on Outbeat News. Say it, say it, say it. Tell it like it is. Now here's Gary Carnevale with tonight's Outbeat Extra.
Dr. Susan Adams currently serves on the board of Marin County Supervisors and has been in that position for 9 years. She has served as the president for the past two. She represents Supervisory District 1, which includes San Rafael, Terralinda, and Marinwood. As a registered nurse, maternity clinical specialist, and a women's health nurse practitioner, she has dedicated her life to building healthy families. Dr. Adams received a doctoral degree in nursing at UCSF and has taught at Dominican University's graduate nursing program. Dr. Adams is also a mother and a grandmother, and one of her sons is joining us tonight, too. Dr. Adams, welcome to Outbeat Radio Extra.
Thank you.
First, tell us why you decided to become a candidate in the 2nd Congressional District primary race.
I think I have a unique set of skills that will benefit the 2nd District. I am 9 years on the Marin Board of Supervisors, where we're elected based on what we're going to deliver for the community rather than our partisan politics. And I've been delivering the goods, have won some pretty tough battles. But I also bring a background in healthcare that is unique among the candidates. I swim the best in that arena of the other candidates and have been a nurse for 33 years. So my focus in health policy has been healthy planet, healthy communities, and that includes everything from personal health to how we create healthy infrastructure and how we have a healthy economy. So I think that the skills that I bring are different, unique, and I'm a fighter and I will work hard for the community.
And talk about some of your other qualifications and some of the other positions you've served.
Well, I'm, you know, as a member of the Board of Supervisors, I have been representing Marin on the Association of Bay Area Governments as we're grappling with how we're going to grow in the Bay Area over the next couple of decades. I serve on the California State Association of Counties and the National Association of Counties, mostly with the health steering committees. And at the National Association, I was instrumental in helping to lead our group through policy and platform changes that got the attention of the Obama administration, and our counties actually had a seat at the table. Supervisor Valerie Brown was our president of NACO at that time, and she was able to carry that forward on behalf of counties. So we've been very actively engaged on the national level.
On Saturday, January 21st, last Saturday, the state Democratic Party regional delegates met in Santa Rosa, but failed to agree on which of the 11 candidates to endorse. You gathered 12% of the delegates, placing you in third place. Because one candidate failed to gather 50% of the votes, none of the candidates in the race will benefit from mailers and other advertising paid for by the state party. What are your thoughts about the meeting, and how does it affect your campaign?
There were a number of the candidates in that group that chose a no endorsement approach too, and a number of those members are also people that have indicated they were going to support me. I actually support that the endorsement was not made in the primary in a very heavily Democratic district with very good Democratic candidates to choose from. I think it's important that we be able to vet our issues and differences and let the public decide which which candidate or candidates in an open primary would go to November. And it could very well be that there are two Democratic candidates that go to November in a district that has the majority of the voters being either Democrat or independents who lean toward Democrat.
Talk about some of the other endorsements you have gathered.
Well, I'm very proud of my endorsement from the American Nurses Association. I also have the support of the California Association of Nurse Practitioners. I have a number of endorsements from local elected people who have worked with me on regional boards as well as up and down the coast. And, you know, I think that it's not so much about the endorsements that you have, but about the message that you bring and about how you resonate with the everyday working people that are tired of what's happening in Washington. They're tired of the political rhetoric. They're tired of the chest thumping, and they want to really see some problem solving. They want their elected leaders to actually get busy on fixing what's going wrong in this country.
Let's move on to some of the topics that are of interest to the LGBT community you seek to represent, or you represent currently in Marin. Six states, along with the District of Columbia and two Native American tribes, now allow equal marriage rights to same-sex couples. A handful of others, including California, are moving towards being added to that list. Because of the Defense of Marriage Act, the federal government does not recognize same-sex marriages, and marriage is now described as a union between one man and one woman. What is your position concerning DOMA?
Well, as the mother of a gay daughter who has provided me with a couple of amazing grandsons, I have been fighting for the cause of equality in marriage for quite a number of years now. And I had our board craft a resolution in support of Gavin Newsom when he was taking that first step and saying, hey, you know, we've really got to tackle this issue. I understand that there are people of the religious community that have a certain belief system, but when you have couples that love each other and they are sharing a life together, sharing families together, and getting a differential treatment in how you get to have access to benefits, whether it's your partner being able to have the determination about what happens to you if you're on life support, to child custody issues, I think that it's time for us to really take a serious look. And if we really believe that this country is based on equality for all of us, regardless of where we come from, and that's what makes our country so strong, I think it's an issue that we really need to grapple with.
If elected, what steps would you take to bring about equal marriage rights for same-sex couples on a federal level?
Well, I think continuing to be a voice, bringing my personal experiences with my daughter, demonstrating to people that my daughter's family is just as legitimate as anybody else's family. But also, you know, this brings up the issue of, you know, we haven't even been able to achieve the Equal Rights Amendment for women, let alone for gay rights issues. And, you know, we have a long way to go on a number of equal rights issues. And as a woman, I think I bring that kind of voice to the table.
In many states, laws deny same-sex couples the right to adopt children, sometimes even the children of their partners. What is your position concerning the ability of same-sex couples and single LGBT folks to become foster parents and/or adopt children?
I support children having a loving home, and it doesn't matter to me where that loving home is. We have a number of children that are being neglected, isolated within a foster system, bounced around and feeling unloved, unmentored, and not taken care of. And there are many loving gay families that have raised some incredible children. I have two incredible grandchildren myself that are thriving quite well. And if the alternative is to have a child being bounced around and not having stability instead of being in a stable home, I think that in every instance you choose the stable home for that child.
While we're on the subject of families, let's talk a bit about the effect the lack of immigration reform has on same-sex couples, especially those here in California who cannot legally marry at this time. Some face deportations to countries where LGBT individuals are often harassed, attacked, or even murdered. What steps can be taken to make certain LGBT couples and families are not torn apart while the federal government comes to terms with this country's immigration problems?
Right, and it's not just the LGBT couples that are dealing with this separation issue. There are many families, heterosexual families, that are being torn apart and separated. I think our federal government has not done a very good job in addressing our immigration issues with at least 12 million undocumented people in this country. It's not likely that we're going to put every one of them on a plane and send them back. And the discrimination isn't just with the gay family issues. It's also targeting immigration as being only the people living south of the border who are of Hispanic descent. We have a number of Asian, Canadian, Swedish, Irish, and African people that are here in an undocumented way too, and we really need to get serious about it. I think even John McCain made an attempt to try to address that through guest worker program and a fast track toward legalization. And if you're contributing to the community, if you have a job, if you're employable and your employer is working with you, I think that there are some solutions that we can find to help us address this issue.
And talk about some of those solutions. Talk about some of your ideas concerning immigration.
Well, the guest worker program, if you've already been here, you've been working for an employer that has been needing your services and you are not getting into trouble with the law. If you've served in the military and you have contributed to our community, I think that there should be a fast track for you to be able to access a legal worker visitor, whatever it is we want to call it, permit with a number so that you can actually have a legal Social Security number and contribute into the system. One of the biggest complaints that we hear is that the undocumented people aren't contributing to the taxes, when in fact there are a large number of them that are contributing using numbers that aren't their own, and there's a whole pile of money in the Social Security Administration that is not going to
tens of billions.
Yes, a lot of money. And so rather than have it be, money that is not legally in the system, let's figure out the way to make this work. I know that my county colleagues south of the border, I mean not south of the border, toward the southern end of the state border, rely very heavily on immigrant farm workers, and it's very difficult work. There aren't a lot of people lining up for those types of jobs, and yet our agricultural industry, one of our largest industries in this state, relies on our immigrant farm workers. So it is a complicated issue, but I think that there needs to be some real leadership and having the discussion and really finding solutions that are meaningful.
So you would support the DREAM Act, which would allow fast track legalization for young people who graduate from college or who have served in the military.
Right.
There seems to be a greater separation between red states and blue states and even the communities within each when it comes to the issue of protecting LGBT children and young adults in our schools. For example, in Tennessee, the state legislature has taken up the same bill numerous times that would prohibit teachers and administrators from even mentioning words like gay and lesbian. Some educators say such laws would prohibit them from stopping bullying. What can be done on the federal level to ensure all children have access to an education in a safe environment?
And the operative word is all children. I mean, we have this No Child Left Behind program that I think has left a lot of our children behind and has also tied the hands of many of our educators in being able to address not only the educational issues but the social issues in their classroom environment. I think we have failed in that regard. We used to be one of the top educated states in the whole country, and we're down at, number 48 now. We need to really pay attention to ensuring that our children are prepared for a global economy, that they learn how to do conflict resolution in a meaningful, respectful way, and that we as adults need to be examples of that to our children. It can't all be in the classroom that this happens. I think families have a responsibility as well to help their children understand how to deal with each other in a respectful way.
Congress has on a number of occasions, 9 to be exact, taken up the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, which would ensure that LGBT individuals are not discriminated against in the workplace. Some members of Congress have had a problem with the inclusion of transgender folks In fact, some LGBT groups have been torn on the issue. Some believe it's an all, meaning the inclusion of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender individuals, or nothing. Other gay groups and some representatives are of the opinion that passing a version of the bill that excludes trans and transgender folks is a good start. What is your position on ENDA and who should be protected?
Well, again, I'll refer to what I said earlier. When we're talking about equal rights, it needs to apply to everybody. And I don't know that there needs to be a qualification about that. And as I said earlier also, we still haven't figured out the women's issues. I mean, women are still paid less than men in the workplace as well. And there's harassment in the workplace for women. So, you know, certainly we need, you know, I don't know that all of it is federal law that is going to get us there. I think you have to have a work environment where the workforce also demands it as well. And there's a lot of things that are happening in some work environments that are really wonderful and creative, and they did need a federal law to do it. But certainly the laws are meant to help protect those agencies that aren't coming to terms with the need to treat everybody fairly and equally.
And as a Marin supervisor, have you dealt with the issue of transgender discrimination or LGBT discrimination?
We actually, in Marin County, we had domestic partnership benefits. We've done a lot in terms of ensuring that the workers in our workforce are treated fairly, equally in terms of benefits, in terms of access to environment, work environment. And we have a very strong policy against any type of discrimination that occurs in the workplace. And we deal with that quickly.
During these challenging economic times, both state and federal funding for local HIV/AIDS organizations have been slashed. Couple this with the rising medical costs, as you're well aware of, and the threats to programs that provide infected folks with a safety net, and some members of our community are at great risk. What would you do to make certain the funding for services is not only maintained, but is increased as necessary on a federal level?
Again, this is the area that I swim the best with. When I was in clinical practice at UCSF, a number of my clients were duly diagnosed pregnant women who were IV drug users, and some of them HIV positive as well. So it's not only just in the gay and lesbian community that HIV is an issue. And certainly with the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, we have an opportunity to ensure that everybody gets the care that they need so that the funding is there. What we really need is Medicare for all. And I've been, through my work with CNA as a labor negotiator, I have been a single payer advocate for quite a long time. I think that that's the way that everybody gets the care that they need without having to silo certain conditions into certain areas, and having primary care and prevention and education so that our community members know how to protect themselves from getting disease, whether it's HIV or hypertension or cardiac or lung disease, I think is very important. And when you invest in prevention, you save a lot of costs in the downstream. The reason why Medicare, which is health care for all, is having some problems is because we have the sickest, most infirmed and oldest people getting health care for all, and you avoid having the pool of health care that will help to offset the costs for the rest of the community. So my concern right now is what might happen with the Supreme Court, and if they toss out one part of it, apparently the severability clause is non-existent in that piece of legislation, and that could risk the whole bill going out the door. And there are some good things. There's about 10 pages worth of really good policy in that 2,000-page behemoth. So I would hate to see that we lose traction. Hmm.
The GOP seems poised to stop the government's federal funding of NPR and PBS, and some Democrats are often too willing to give up the fight. Couple this with the mergers of huge telecommunication corporations, and the result is that the voice of minority groups, such as the LGBT community, is being silenced. In Santa Rosa, the Community Media Center provides opportunities to any Sonoma County resident, much like the facility in Marin, and provides and residents can produce programming, and then it is aired on the cable access channels operated by the CMC. Right now, the CMC is embroiled in a heated contract negotiation with the city of Santa Rosa that may result in the silencing of more minority voices. Such local cable access channels, as well as local NPR and PBS TV and radio stations, provide the community with important information. If elected, what would you do to ensure the continued funding of local NPR and PBS stations and that other community-based broadcasters are given a fair shake?
Well, in my work in Marin County, when I was on the Marin Telecommunications Agency, I went to the mats to get funding, $3 million worth of funding to start our media center, because our public media centers are our public squares. They're our town squares. That's where a whole variety of issues can be aired and where we get a chance to debate them without having the corporate influence on different opinions. It's vitally important that we still have that venue. And I've been allowed and vocal advocate to protect our public media, and we'll continue to do that on the federal level.
Now that we've covered topics that are, in our opinion, of key interest to the local LGBT community, realize that members of our community are impacted by many of the same problems that impact the general population. You've touched on a few of them. In our remaining few minutes, talk about some of the other issues that you, should you be elected, would tackle.
Well, I've already mentioned the health care for all, and that's certainly where I'm very strong in that area, but I'm also very strong in the area of clean energy. And I do believe that we do have climate change. This has been very unusual weather, if you've noticed. We have another beautiful evening out there. And that, you know, one of the things that we need to do is really start looking at how do we move away from fossil fuel and really start looking at a clean energy future. In Marin County, I helped to launch the Marin Energy Authority, the clean energy program, and with the goal being in 10 years, we'll be off the fossil fuel grid. And my vision for the 2nd Congressional District would be that the whole district would show the rest of the country how to be off the fossil fuel grid in the next 10 years. We're already having conversations with Arcata, and even Healdsburg is engaging in some conversations. But there are a number of other issues, like the fight for women's reproductive rights. And as an OBGYN nurse practitioner, I actually have provided reproductive rights for women during my whole career. And that would be something that I certainly would bring. Our coast and protecting our coast, clean water, clean air. There are a whole variety of issues. And at the local level, I've had experiences in solving problems with a number of those. And I believe that I can bring those successes with me and that fight that I have in me to Washington and be successful. I'm not a stranger to Washington, and I have good relationships with the regulatory agencies and a number of the congressional leaders, so I'm ready for this.
Mm. I'm going to squeeze in one more quick question about the SMART train. What's your position on the SMART train?
The SMART train, the funding that was being asked for when it was first asked for was not enough. That was my only beef with them. And that was before the recession. But now that we have it and we're getting the contracts going and you have Farhad Mansourian at the helm, if anybody can make it work, he's the guy that can make it work. I wasn't so happy he got kidnapped away from our county. But he's definitely the logistics guy that can make this work. And I think offering another mode of transportation besides the single occupancy vehicle is important.
Great. How can people learn more about you and your campaign?
You can go to www.susanadamsforcongress.com, and there's all kinds of really good information on there. And you can also contact me directly if you have questions for me. I try to return phone calls.
Beautiful. You certainly do. Dr. Adams, thank you for joining us tonight, and we wish you the very best.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
And stay with us. There's lots more to come. We're going to take a quick music break. You're listening to KRCB-FM, Santa Rosa.
This is my room, and it's robin's egg blue, and it's got a few cracks in the ceiling. This is my street where the Minutemen meet, and Dad says that I'll never be leaving. I'm 10 years old, but I know how to smoke, and the drinks help to cure the bad feelings. This is my home, and the sticks and the stones are made up of the darkest of things. But in my dreams, I can fly. and I soar, and my feet touch the sky, and it seems I can go anywhere if I try, and the world's not so dark when the clouds make it white. If there's no hope, tell me why. In my dreams I can fly. Here come the tears and I cover my ears, and I swear I can hear my own heart beat. When they stop fighting to turn out the lights, I pretend that I'm already sleeping. After the violence, alone in the silence, just me and the secret I'm keeping. My dad tells me I'm not worth anything, and I've almost admitted defeat. But in my dreams, I can fly, and I soar, and my feet touch the sky, and it seems I can go anywhere if I try, and the world's not so dark when the clouds make it white. If there's no hope, tell me why. In my dreams I can fly. In my dreams I can fly. This is my room and it's robin's egg blue, and it's got a few cracks in the ceiling. This is my home and the sticks and the stones are made up of the darkest of things. After the violence, alone in the silence, just me and the secret I'm keeping. My dad tells me I'm not worth anything, and I've almost admitted it, but in my dreams I can fly. And I soar, and my feet touch the sky, and it seems I can go anywhere if I try, and the world's not so dark when the clouds make it white. If there's no hope, tell me why. In my dreams I can fly, and my feet touch the sky, and it seems I can go anywhere if I try, and the world's not so dark when the clouds make it white. If there's no hope, tell me why. In my dreams I can fly. If there's no hope, tell me why. In my dreams I can fly. If there's no hope, tell me why. In my dreams I can fly.
And that was local artist Bobby Joe Valentine with Fly from his album A Place to Belong. You're listening to Outbeat Extra here on KRCB-FM Santa Rosa. This is a special show. We're exposing you to some of the candidates hoping to take a seat in the U.S. Congress tonight. I'm here with Gary Carnevale. Gary?
Norman Solomon is an author, policy researcher, public interest advocate, and a political activist. He is in his third term as an elected delegate from the North Bay to the California Democratic Party's Central Committee. In 2008, he was elected as an Obama delegate from Sonoma and Marin counties to the Democratic National Convention. His books include War Made Easy, How Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. Mr. Solomon lives with his wife, Cheryl Higgins, who is a nurse practitioner in Inverness Park. Mr. Solomon, welcome to Outbeat Radio Extra.
Hey, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
First off, tell us why you decided to become a candidate for the 2nd Congressional District primary race.
Well, I've been an activist for 45 years. I'm 60 years old now, and I've been immersed in organizing, speaking, writing on behalf of social justice and equity. And what we see happening with the federal government, I think, is a tragedy, and yet there are some reasons for hope. We know now that for the first time in 20 years, we're going to have a new representative in Congress. And given that this is a heavily Democratic district, we know at the end of the day, a Democrat is going to represent us. The question is what kind of Democrat. And the work I've done for human rights, the environment, alternatives to war, finding ways for social equity, that is what I'd like to bring to Congress and serve as a representative in that way.
Talk about some of your other qualifications.
Well, you know, I've written 12 books that deal with public policy, media, way in which state, federal, local government action and inaction either protect us or harm us. And I really have been sort of at the nexus, you might say, of research, activism, organizing, and advocacy, whether in media or community organizing, ways that we can build coalitions. I'm a coalition builder. I'm an unabashed progressive. I make no bones about it. I believe that we've got to struggle for equality. In my own lifetime, I saw and then participated in the civil rights movement. The first time I went on a picket line, it was in 1966. I lived in Maryland, and there was an all-white apartment complex. Mm. And it wasn't that comfortable to me to, gee, you pick up a picket sign and you walk around in a circle in front of the building. Mm. But I did it, and it felt very good to me to say, I believe in racial equality. We need to challenge the bigotry that says you have to have white skin to be at this apartment complex as a resident. And I see just the concentric issues there, women's rights, gay rights, the necessity for people who are low income to be treated with just as much dignity and respect as anybody else. And when I've gone to Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, I've seen the consequences of poverty, and I've seen the consequences of what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called the madness of militarism. I have no doubt that if Dr. King were with us today, he would be an advocate for the LGBT community and for full civil rights. And I think that's our future. The question is, how fast can we get there, and how much suffering can we prevent by getting there fast enough?
Mm. Talk about those trips to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I founded in 1998 an organization called the Institute for Public Accuracy, and it's a nonprofit organization. And we do basically, you might say, pro bono media work to try to get progressive voices onto TV, radio, into newspapers, and so forth. A lot of times folks that don't have the money to hire anybody to help them get into the media. So in the course of that, when there was the buildup after George W. Bush was elected president, or I don't know if he was elected president, but he got to be president. When the war drums were beating through the institute that I founded, I organized three trips to Baghdad before the invasion of Iraq. I took a member of Congress, Nick Rahal from West Virginia. I took Sean Penn, and I took a UN official in January of 2003. And in the course of those visits, we had meetings with Tariq Aziz, the second in command of the Iraqi government. I'm very proud that after the first visit that I organized, we had, for the first time in 4 years, Saddam Hussein's government allowed UN weapons inspectors back in. And you can imagine when that happened, it was announced 2 days after our meeting. Mm. This was in September 2002. At the White House, that was the last thing they wanted. They wanted the UN to stay the heck out. They were looking for a clear path to begin to bomb Iraq, which, of course, is unfortunately what the Bush administration proceeded to do in March of 2003. And tremendous amount of suffering, of course, Iraqis and Americans as a result. When I went back to Iraq in December of 2002, with Sean Penn, it was after trying to get other members of Congress to go on follow-up trips, because I felt that if there could be more conversation and more discussion, there'd be less of a chance of war breaking out. Unfortunately, and this is one of the main reasons I'm running for Congress to represent the North Bay in this new North Coast district, many people in Congress, they're scared. They want to be conformist. They don't want anybody in power, even in their own party, yelling at them and scolding them, saying, we're not going to give you campaign contributions. And I saw that happening in my own eyes. I got back from Baghdad in September 2002. I called dozens of congressional offices. The trip went very well. It was very successful. We had the weapons inspectors back in from the United Nations. and they wouldn't go. I called some of the most progressive members of Congress, and they had all sorts of reasons why they wouldn't go. And so I cast the net wider. And that's where Sean Penn, who I did not know at that point, he didn't know me from a hole in the wall, he responded to my letter. We met in Marin County, and a few days later, we were in Baghdad together. And that experience said, and he was so eloquent in saying, we did a news conference together after being in Baghdad for a few days. Sean Penn said, look, this is about children's lives and the future. And he got trashed by the Murdoch press, by Fox News. They called him Baghdad Sean and all the rest of it. He had it right because he was connecting to human beings as human beings. And really, I think that's what a member of Congress should and must do. This policy wonk stuff can sound dry as dust on TV and radio, but human lives are at stake with all sorts of policies, and we have to put human lives ahead of the military-industrial complex or the bigotry that still thrives in a lot of this country.
And that bigotry extends to not affording same-sex couples equal marriage rights.
Oh, well, absolutely. I think that the reality of this statement is being played out right in front of us. When people lead, the leaders will follow. It was people at the grassroots who said that marriage equality has to be the law of the land in this country. And I not only totally support marriage equality, I think that any laws which discriminate, whether we're talking about inheritance or visits in a prison or visits in a hospital, that distinguish between two people on the basis of race, gender, sexual orientation, that's totally wrong. And we have to drag our country, and sometimes it is like dragging, into the 21st century, because these are human rights issues.
And so what is your position concerning the ability of same-sex couples and single LGBT folks to become foster parents and or adopt children?
It has to be the same standard as anybody else. You know, whether somebody is bisexual, gay, or heterosexual or whatever, we should have the same standards. We do the inspections of the home. We do the background checks. And it has to be on an equal basis. As soon as you skew it one way or the other, then equal protection under the law goes out the window. And that should just be unacceptable.
Let's talk about the effect that the lack of immigration reform has on same-sex couples, especially those here in California who cannot legally marry. Some face deportation to countries where LGBT individuals are often harassed, attacked, or even murdered, like Afghanistan and Iraq, Iran. What steps can be taken to make a certain LGBT couples and families are not torn apart while the federal government comes to terms with this country's immigration problems?
Well, I think that federal officials and federal law, all government law, should be unequivocal, speaking with one clear voice in terms of language, statements, and reality, and also policy. And when there's any sort of split between the two, you've got problems. So in affirming the human rights, that has to extend to immigrants. You don't treat people differently because of their sexual orientation. You don't break up families or try to define families differently depending on the sexual orientation of people in the families. And once we can clear away what I think is just rubbish and garbage from the past of bigotry, prejudice, and ignorance, then we get on, as Hubert Humphrey said in the context of civil rights when he spoke to the Democratic National Convention in 1948, we walk into the sunshine of human rights. We're still waiting to get out into the full sunshine, but we're making progress. And I think that there is an issue that comes up here. It applies to immigration because we know we've had draconian measures in Arizona, in Alabama, and elsewhere. I went to Tucson, Arizona, a couple years back. I campaigned for Raul Grijalva because he had come under threat from John McCain and right-wing Republicans, Grover Norquist. They dumped a ton of money against him 2 years ago. Grijalva, who, by the way, is co-chair of the Progressive Caucus in Congress, he's endorsed me for election in this race. He spoke out and he said, as long as we're going to have this racial profiling immigration law in Arizona, then we should boycott this state. And, of course, all hell broke loose, and the Republicans tried to take him out. I think on immigration across the board, again, these are human rights issues. And when you see a human being, you say, this is somebody who has full human rights, and we don't start to parse and splice and dice and say, well, you have the quote-unquote wrong race, ethnicity, language capacity, sexual orientation, gender, whatever. You don't have enough money. This is a quest that we have that's imperfect. And I'm old enough to remember when there was debate on television. I remember debate between James Baldwin and James Kirkpatrick over whether a state should be able to ban or allow discrimination at a lunch counter. And now we think, well, this is wacky. Mm-hmm. How could it even have been open for? It should have been just clear as possible. But at the time, it was a debate. And I think marriage equality is an example of where we are there today. There's still some debate. But a couple decades from now, there's going to be a next generation that say, how could it even have ever been a question?
And do you feel the same about the immigration issue? That how far down the road will it, we need to be before that? Those solutions come about.
Well, I think we need to accelerate the human rights social change so we can get down that road as quick as possible. And I think, again, the definition, just as definition of family needs to fully embrace human rights, that the definition of all sorts of marriages needs to be embraced with a single standard. I mean, once we say, okay, that's a marriage and that isn't between two consenting adults, or that's a family and that isn't, then you're down this very slippery slope, which is basically trying to put the humanity of one person above the humanity of the other. Mm. And that's totally wrong. One statement that has stayed with me for more than a decade, I heard Gore Vidal give a speech, and he said, humanity has no gender, race, religion, or sexual orientation. It's a simple statement. And it's a very profound statement. It's not that easy, really, to fully wrap your mind around it at first, because it has so many implications. And the news media, and I have been, you know, a journalist, I'm a media critic, I was a founder of the Media Watch Group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. There's been wonderful work done by the GLAAD Group and others. FAIR as well, since 1985, we fought against bias in media based on race, gender, sexual orientation, and we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. We have a tremendous amount of messaging coming from the mass media and quite a few politicians still that is discriminatory in terms of, oh, this person has more legitimacy or should in terms of legal standing. And I think we need to challenge that because that's part of the democratic process.
And I was thinking the other day about the difference between the way the media handled the Gwen Arahu story, a transgender teen that was killed almost 10 years ago, and the way that issue is dealt with now, and leaps and bounds. But in many state legislatures, they're considering legislation that would ban teachers and other educators from even saying the word gay. Some educators say that such laws would prohibit them from stopping bullying, which is, seems to be a huge issue, and not just LGBT teens, but also teens of other races and religions. Right. What can be done at a federal level to ensure all children have access to an education in a safe environment?
Well, I think that the federal government has much more of a role, should have much more of a role in education policy than it does. That's economic as well, to make sure every child, for instance, we have an issue now in this state, can kids get a ride to their public school, the school bus, these massive cutbacks. Can kids have a small enough class size? Can they have competent enough teachers? Can they have a building and the facilities and the internet and so forth? That should be federal responsibility, and also the human rights of students as well. And to have programs that encourage the human right affirmation of all students. Now, we know that curricula is a state and local level. I think that's as it should be. But every student in the United States has a right to full quality education without being subjected to bullying. And I really would want to commend State Senator Mark Leno, you know, the legislation to say, we're going to teach in our schools that bigotry is wrong. You know, I grew up at a time when Barry Goldwater was saying you can't legislate morality. Wrong. You can. We do that all the time. Mm. It's not okay to walk down the street and hit somebody upside the head. It's not okay to harass people. It's not okay to teach hatred in the public schools. On the contrary, public schools have a responsibility to affirm the humanity of all. So I think that's a process that it's a widening of consciousness. I mean, I didn't know what transgender was 30 years ago. You know, it's something that we learn about And as we learn, our consciousness expands, but it's not enough to expand our consciousness. We have to expand our laws so that everybody's fully protected. Mm.
And transgender folks always seems to be the sticking point. It is when it comes to the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, which has been taken up on several occasions by the Congress. In fact, some groups have come down on either side of the issue, saying that, you know, maybe we should just have gay and lesbian spoken for first, and then we'll deal with transgender folks later. What is your position on ENDA, and who should be protected?
This is not a binary world. We may live in the digital age, but that doesn't mean that everything gets divided into two categories, pulse on and off. And I think it's part of our growth of understanding of what human rights are, what humanity is, who people are, that we're not putting people into boxes and categories. That's why we say LGBT. And that's why we're willing to affirm everybody's sexual orientation and sexual choices. And as adults, people have a right, as long as they're not hurting anybody else, to engage in consensual sex and to be who they are. And I think the federal government laws need to, again, catch up to the 21st century. And consciousness is here. We just need to make sure the laws affirm human rights rather than hold them back.
During these tough economic times, it's been difficult for HIV/AIDS organizations to maintain their funding, especially on from the federal government. What would you do to make certain that the funding for services are not only maintained but are increased as is probably necessary?
Well, that's a congressional and federal responsibility. When I met my wife, Cheryl Higgins, 20 years ago, she was working in the AIDS unit of Oakland Children's Hospital. And at the time, you know, when you think back, this was 1990. There was still a lot of misinformation around. She was working in a pediatric AIDS department as well as elsewhere. And I think that funding has ebbed and flowed. Clearly, the bigotry of the Reagan administration killed many people. Bigotry is still killing many people in terms of clotting, so to speak, or impeding the flow of federal dollars. And we need to treat AIDS still as a health emergency. And what you do with a health emergency is that you fund programs for prevention and treatment. I'm co-chair of the Healthcare Not Warfare campaign with Donna Smith from the California Nurses Association and Congressman John Conyers. And the Healthcare Not Warfare campaign is about, we're going to stop spending this money on war after war, endless war, and we're going to take that money and we're going to take care of people, their needs for education and health care and housing. And AIDS is a clear instance there. We need massive increases of funding that will save lives. And frankly, if we spend less money on the Pentagon, we'll save money two ways. We'll save lives two ways. People will not be dying so much in wars, and we can spend money on health care so that lives can be preserved and enhanced and extended.
As a journalist and someone who comments on the media, I'm sure you're aware of the GOP's sort of fight to stop government's funding of NPR and PBS. There are these huge mergers of telecommunications, and they usually result in minorities having their voice silenced, and that includes the LGBT community. There's a community media center that's in Santa Rosa that's come under threat because of issues with the city of Santa Rosa. If elected, what would you do to ensure the continued funding of local NPR and PBS stations and other community-based broadcasters, and making sure that other broadcasters are given a fair shake in this market?
Well, I served for 5 years on the board of directors of KBOO Radio in Portland, a non-commercial listener-supported station in the 1970s. I believe totally in community radio. I think the funding from Corporation for Public Broadcasting should be increased with no political strings. And too often, as we saw with Sheila Tate from the Reagan administration, the pressure was used to try to manipulate and constrain, whereas the mandate of the Carnegie Commission from 1967 was to expand the airwaves through public broadcasting. And that, frankly, it's sort of the good news, bad news. Outbeat How many shows are there like Outbeat on the public airwaves? There should be hundreds and hundreds. And the innovative programs that are being done are precious and conspicuous because we don't have a diversity of power on the airwaves. That's where we need to live out that mandate. The federal government needs to fund community broadcasting that's true to the mission of the Carnegie Commission, which is to provide outlets for voices ordinarily not heard. And let's face it, the airwaves are choked with the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys and the bigots, and we've got to provide more airtime for contrary voices.
Now that we've covered a lot of the key issues that are of interest to the LGBT community, we realize that members of our community are impacted by many of the same problems that impact the general population. In our remaining few minutes, talk about some of the other issues that you, should you be elected, would tackle.
Yeah. Well, unemployment and underemployment is just a huge problem. And I don't believe in trickle-down economics. I don't believe in trickle-down job creation. I wear a button when I speak. It says 99%. Wall Street has been running down Main Street. It's pulled us into a ditch. And Wall Street dominates, unfortunately, much of the political decision-making along Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. I'm a strong supporter of a bill presented by John Conyers in Congress that has two key components. First is committing this country to full employment at last. And the second is a 0.25% transaction tax on Wall Street that would provide funding of $150 billion with a B dollars a year that can be provided through the law for job training and job creation. I don't believe in leaving it to the tender mercies of Wall Street to create jobs. It isn't working. And so I'm an unreconstructed New Dealer, Green New Dealer, you might say, and we have to have funding from the federal government to create these long-term jobs and a future for the next generation, including education funding for places like SRJC, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Public education is definitely under attack. Talk a bit about what you would do as a congressman to change that.
Well, I think the fact that only 11% of public education is coming from the feds is just inadequate and unacceptable. And we're seeing that the federal government is the only public investment government entity that can really get the job done through deficit spending. The county, city, state can't do it. Therefore, rather than leave public education twisting in the wind, the federal government has to step up to the plate. Okay, don't build some of those aircraft carriers. Let's pull some more troops out of Afghanistan, and let's fund the local and regional educational projects, not just K through 12, but places like SRJC, Sonoma State, UC System. That's where our future is. The feds have to come through. And I want to go to Congress. And let me say, to do that, solomonforcongress.com is the website, and hope people will visit us there.
Great. Mr. Solomon, thank you for joining us tonight, and we wish you the very best.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Gary, that was great conversation for our first political show.
Thank you.
And so that wraps up this edition of Outbeat Extra. If you'd like to listen to the interviews we played tonight and share them with someone who maybe wasn't able to tune in, check out our website at outbeatradio.com. The show should be available for play in the next day or so. Be sure to tune in next week for Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greer. They'll be joined by Jay Foxworthy and Brian Lefeu. That's the gay couple from Santa Rosa you heard us talk about in the news, who are featured in the documentary called A Right to Love, an American Family. And that's next Sunday night at 8 p.m., right here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a fantastic week, and thanks so much for spending your Sunday evening with us. On the air and online, we are the North Bay Public Media Connection, KRCB FM Santa Rosa, at 91.1 and 90.9 FM, streaming live at krcb.org. It's just before 9 p.m. Stay with us. New Dimensions is next.